Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest exciting adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the voice you've all been waiting to hear once again, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this fine day?
Oh, good, but that was a very big build-up. Let's try and live up to that, shall we?
Yes, you will live up to that. And I'll tell you what we'll start with. We'll start with a bit of music, because, of course, you are an expert. Why am I singing you this? Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean to say that I'm not going to be dead. Or something like that, anyway.
Something like that. Exactly. Yeah, that song has been in the news the last couple of days. Now, remind me why, because I must have consumed, like you, about 2 million words in the last few days. Yeah, sure. I can't remember the link, but I know I've read that in the last few days.
Guy who wrote it is dead.
Oh, right, okay.
Jay Johnson or something is his name, was it? Hang on. Well, I've got a cutting here, so I must have. I know what I'm doing, don't worry. Did he say it laughingly?
Just talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, please, just talk amongst yourselves. Yeah, the guy who wrote that song, which featured, of course, in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, has died. It was one of the most famous songs ever that appeared in a musical. But the great story behind it is, because I read the obituary, Robert Redford wanted it taken out of the film because it was Paul Newman and Robert Redford, right? And Robert Redford said, why is this song in our film? He says, most of it takes place in the desert and in South America. There isn't any rain. Why are we singing Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head? And everybody said, well, it's just, you know, it's a great song. And it was written by this B.J. Johnson guy, but Burt Bacharach, I think, had something to do with it as well. Anyway, look. I think you'd agree with me.
I always thought it was a Burt Bacharach song, actually. That shows how things kind of sink in and out of history, doesn't it?
Well, hang on. Maybe B.J. Johnson, over his name, was the guy who sang it. Hang on, I've got to find this. Wait a minute. I'm getting a bit upset with myself here because I don't see what I'm doing, you know?
He's all over the place.
All over the place.
He hasn't got his notes together. It's all that beer you drink in the mornings.
Here it is. I found it. Look, I'm on good form after all. I thought it was. Right, here we go.
He says this now.
Country pop American singer whose 1978 Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head rocked the world. B.J. Thomas, the singer. Oh, you're absolutely right. He was the singer, but the guy who wrote it was, as you quite rightly say, you're ahead of the game again, Miss Jones, was Burt Bacharach.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah. 1970, I don't remember that film. I mean, I know the name of the film. Obviously, I know about Robert Redford and Paul Newman. I don't remember having seen that film because it's a long, long time
ago.
Oh,
it's a classic film. I've seen it a couple of times, you know, Redford and Paul Newman. It's where they first forged the great partnership, which led, I think, to The Great Gatsby, was it, or something like that? Did they star in another film?
They weren't in The Great Gatsby together. Robert Redford was in that.
Was he? Okay.
With Mia Farrow.
Yeah,
and Patsy Kensit was in that, playing their child. A bit of trivia there. But it's amazing how things move on so quickly and how things do fall out of common memory.
Yes.
I was talking to an editor of mine the other day about the Rolling Stones film Performance. There were controversial aspects to that film. There was, a live sex act took place on that film, in that film. And not only did he not know about this, but he hadn't even heard of the film. Because, of course, it's back in the 70s, and he was nowhere near born at that stage. He's only 30.
God. I mean, it was the only film that Mick Jagger made until he disastrously made a film about Ned Kelly, the Australian bushranger, which was left out of the cinemas, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think he was trying to emulate David Bowie's success as a screen actor, because Bowie wasn't a great film idol either, really. Yeah. They should stick to what they know, these people, I always think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Now, Ms. Jones, I've heard rumours, and it remains nothing more than a rumour, but of course, you know, news moves fast in the media village, that you have recently been in one of your member clubs downing numerous bottles of Cave across the table from a bunch of other literary greats.
Who told you that?
I find these things out. I just want to know to what depths of depravity this lunch might have descended to.
Oh, come on. I went to the Groucho Club. of which I am a founder member. My kids always tease me and say, oh God, she's a founder member of Marks and Spencer's. No, I had a lovely lunch with an editor, which was epic, actually. It lasted 6 hours. Those were the days when we used to go on six-hour lunches. Do you remember?
I couldn't last a six-hour lunch now. I'd not be able to. No, I wouldn't be able to find my way home, honestly. Just towards the end of lockdown, I went with a friend to an Italian restaurant in Bow Lane, and they got away with serving us, you know, a great meal and lots of drinks and all that in what looked like an inside sort of arrangement, but it was in fact a huge tarpaulin they pulled over the terrace at the side of the Italian restaurant to make it, you know, it complied with the laws to be outdoors, but it was really indoor. And I have to say, that was about 4 hours, and I still can't remember how I got home. So I try to steer away from those things these days. I'm afraid I've just run out of energy.
You know what it is? You get the taste for it. And we used to do those kind of lunches all the time. But yeah, part of your job was doing lunches like that, because the more drunk you got somebody, frankly, the more likely they were to cough the goods, spill the beans, and all those euphemisms. Yeah. But you have the first bottle of wine, and then you've got the taste for this lovely bottle of Gavi de Gavi, and you think, oh yeah, that goes down very quickly. The waitress comes along, would you like another one? Oh yes, please. Yeah. And then by the time you finish the second one, which seems to go faster than the first one, then, you know, a third bottle seems like a no-brainer, at which point you don't need it, you don't taste it, and you're just sort of topping up your level of inebriation. It was very great fun.
Totally agree. Talking about wine, by the way, I read a piece on one of the great social embarrassment problems of our times. I don't suppose you go to dinner parties anymore, do you, even when the world opens up again?
No, I'm persona non grata because I'm single. And of course, nobody invites single women to dinner parties. Well, single men are always very desirable.
Oh, Ms. Jones, you know, if I was having a dinner party, I would definitely invite you as a single woman, as a magnet to other male members coming, okay?
Male members.
Sorry. Family show.
I don't want to go to dinner parties anymore. I used to go to and give quite a lot of dinner parties in the past when my children were little, because that was how we socialized. Yes. You either had your kids upstairs, or if you were in somebody else's house, they would bring their kids, and you know, somebody would mind them upstairs while you had this raucous dinner party.
Yes.
But quite honestly, how boring.
Yeah.
I could not be asked anymore.
I can't either, to be honest. I never want to sit around a table with people who I don't intimately know. I've got to the age now where I'm not going to waste time trying to get to know people, or trying to discover people, or trying to see if there's any interesting or fascinating about their lives. And I say this without, I'm not being big-headed, but most people haven't had lives like you and me, okay? So you go off to some dinner party, you're sitting there, and somebody's telling you about the adventures of being an accountant or something like that. They can't tell you, you know, adventures like yours, of flying across the Atlantic on the Concorde to go meet Naomi Campbell, and then flying on to LA and, you know, rocking up in Mustique at David Bowie's house. And for that reason, and again, I'm not being big-headed, why would I want to go and share some time with somebody who's had a less exciting life than me?
Well, there is that. And also, you don't want to get those kinds of stories out at general dinner parties, because then people think you're boasting. They think you're being big-headed. I tended to always be a bit low-key at those things. But also, the stories sound a bit fantastical and as if you're making them up.
Yes.
And people would always challenge me at dinner parties.
Yes.
And I got sick of trying to defend myself at those kind of events.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did they challenge you about?
Oh, all kinds of things. I remember once I was very evidently pregnant with my youngest child, mm-hmm. and it was a New Year's Eve dinner party.
Right.
And this chap opposite me very pleasantly leant across and said, so where are you having your baby? So I said, oh, at the Portland Hospital, which is a private hospital in London. And
where the royals got born.
Queen Charlotte's mostly, the royals are born. But the Portland, yeah, I think Andrew and Fergie's kids were born at the Portland, for example. So, you know, that's our choice. We didn't have five holidays a year. We didn't have new cars every year. We decided to pay for our children to be born, because that way you stick with the same consultant and you get what you pay for, frankly. Yeah. Yeah. So what's wrong with that? We're supporting the NHS as well, freeing up a place in the NHS and going off and paying for this ourselves. So he got very animated, this chap, and said, don't you think it's the job of people like us to support the NHS and our local hospitals? Yes. And this is somebody who was a dad at our elder child's school. So obviously they had children at fee-paying schools, as did we. So I said, well, don't you think it's the job of people like us to support the local state schools in that case? Yes. Because we are paying for places for our children at the local state school, and we are also paying to educate them privately, which is, of course, our choice. Yeah. So he got so furious about this, and I looked at my husband, and I thought, I was trying to convey to him, it's New Year's Eve, I'm pregnant, this is not fun, should we just go home and open a bottle of champagne?
But not of course, him to drink, of course.
You know, that's, yeah, quite. But that's not what he wanted to do. And so we stuck it out. But when I look back on the amount of time I wasted sitting across tables from people who were determined to pick a fight with me for good reason at all, I don't miss those days.
No, I don't either. I like being in the company of people who I know, like yourself, you know, fascinating company. You've got a tale to tell. And we were
like-minded people with something in common.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
People with the same history. You know, I went on that lunch recently with a bunch of journalists, you know, John Blake and Ethel Witheridge, Pauline Cloud, all of those great guys from the heyday of Fleet Street in the 80s. Yeah. We did not stop talking for about 5 hours, and nobody could get a word in edgeways. It was such fun. It was just like the old days. So you sort of need at this stage in your life to hang with people who you understand and who understand you.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The other point I was going to make about those is, and I read this in a feature from somebody who said it's an eternal problem. When you go to these dinner parties and you take a bottle of wine, you're always measured on how good the wine is that you've brought, whether it's better or worse than the wine that's actually being served on the table. And the social problem is, should the host serve you the wine you've brought because you like it, or should they put it away in a cupboard? And then does it actually end up in somebody else's house later because you take that bottle? Well, do you see what I mean? It's the bottle of wine stuff. I always told people, don't bring any wine. If I had to do at home, you know, I'd say, yeah, come now. I'm providing all the booze, A, because I know what booze I like. So selfishly, I would make sure it was all stuff I liked. But B, I couldn't stand the comparison of who brought what.
Well, the etiquette, of course, is that somebody presents you with a nice bottle of wine. You are supposed to open it and serve it on that occasion. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is the strict etiquette on that. Yeah. But of course, somebody's going to bring, you know, some kind of $7.99 bottle of Planck, and somebody else is going to bring an exceedingly good claret.
Exactly. I remember years ago when I was a trainee student, I got invited to my mate's friend's housewarming. And this guy had already done well in life. He'd set up as an estate agent, and he was getting on in the world and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I didn't know him from Adam, but he was my mate's best mate. And my mate came from wealth. He came from good money. His father was an industrialist in the northeast of England. They lived in a very big house, and I used to go up there and stay with him. So we went round, and I took a litre bottle of Strongbow cider, right, you know.
But, how classy of you.
Yes, exactly. I didn't think any different of it because, you know, I was a trainee student in Chester, in Newcastle, actually, at the training centre in Big Market. I didn't have any money because we didn't get paid anything. But I then started helping myself to a few real drinks, you know what I mean? Like a gin tonic, a slug of whiskey or something like that. And this bloke who was the host, this bloke whose house it was, he got absolutely furious. And he rushed over, you know, in the kitchen where all the drinks were, picked up my Strongbow cider, emptied it down the sink in front of me and everybody else, and said, next time you want to come in and drink my whiskey, bring something more than a bottle of fucking cider. And horrible.
Oh, language, Mr. Perry.
Yeah, excuse the language.
Family show.
Yes, but that was direct quote. It was a direct quote.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
Sorry. So,
I'll let you off then.
So just be like if you read it in the newspaper, direct quote in inverted commas. But it was rather horrible and terribly embarrassing for me. And in my view, totally unnecessary.
Yes, that's extremely rude. So if you invite people to your home, you have a duty to behave like a decent host and not embarrass your guests in front of everyone else.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've had a bit of a shock, I tell you, in the last couple of days. So, a shock almost literally. You know, when you first detect there's something wrong with your tooth, it's because you go, ooh, and it literally was a blackberry pip. I love blackberries, right? And I often have a bowl of blackberries, maybe with a bit of banana. Absolutely lovely and full of vitamin C and all that kind
of stuff. Very good for you, purple fruits. Purple fruits are extremely good for you.
Exactly. And I was just sitting there watching the telly, probably watching Coronation Street, and I suddenly bit on my tooth and, ooh, you know, that sort of electric shock feeling. Ooh,
nasty.
God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I got hold of the dentist next day, and my dentist would see me the following day, but he didn't have any sort of space to do any treatment. He said he'd have a look at it. And I said, I think it's probably a cracked filling or something like that. And I looked in the mirror and I've got a huge, one of those very old fashioned black fillings at the back of my mouth on the lower side of my my jaw. And I thought that must be it. And sure enough, I got there, had an X-ray, and it was that. It had cracked in two. And it was unsettling the tooth. And he said, look, I can't do it today. We will get it done. We'll put a crown in there for you. And I said, oh, okay. I said, not worth another filling. He said, no, these fillings are gone now. Fillings are white now anyway. So, he said, it's not worth it. We'll do a crown. That was all very well. So I went downstairs, because obviously his surgery was on the first floor. And then he said, oh, hi, Mike. Yeah. Do you want to pay for this now or when we do the treatment in 2 weeks? I said, no, let's settle it now. And I thought nothing more of it until she presented me with a bill for £988.
And what?
Yes, honestly.
Was it gold-plated?
No. And do you remember in a couple of podcasts ago, we had the conversation about you can't get an NHS dentist. I mean, you wouldn't get a crown on the NHS anyway, would you?
No, I don't think so. But this is a very expensive crown. Because I had my very first crown last year.
Right.
And it cost me £750. So I think you need a new dentist.
Well, there's not much difference between 750 and 980, really, is there, I suppose?
Quite a couple of hundred quid, yeah. That's quite a lot of money, isn't it?
I suppose it depends on, you know...
That's the price of two appointments.
Yeah, well, this all included the X-ray charges and pre-treatment and, you know, consultation and all that. But I still feel incredibly sorry for anybody who... Supposing I was a bus driver, and there's nothing wrong with bus drivers, I think they're great people and they run a very efficient service where I live in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, but they don't get paid huge amounts of money. Now, if that was a bus driver, went along there, and I don't think a bus driver would, you know, be very comfortable having to shell out £1,000 if they could get £1,000 together to have their tooth fixed. Do you? I think it's becoming more and more of a scandal.
I think that everybody needs to be mindful of the fact that the NHS is not going to last forever. Yeah. And in the vast majority of countries, there is no such thing as free healthcare. And dentistry is no longer part of the free healthcare package, unless you are destitute and you need something doing urgently. Most of us have to pay for our dentistry nowadays.
Yeah.
And there will come a time, probably in our lifetime, when we have to pay for our healthcare as well.
Yeah.
So I think for too long, people have taken it for granted that you can get this kind of thing free. They'll happily go on a package holiday. They'll happily go down the pub and spend up to £100 on a Friday night every week, these people. I'm not saying all bus drivers, but some do. Lots of people in all kinds of types of employment do, but they don't put anything aside for this kind of thing when it happens. And I think there needs to be a reconsideration and a new emphasis on making provision for the sorts of things that happen, because we're all going to need more and more dentistry as we get older.
Yeah, we are. I totally agree. And that's why the NHS is under such strain. Because
it can't last. When it came about in 1948, when Aneurin Bevan, the great Welshman, set up the National Health Service, there were millions fewer people in this country and people didn't live as long.
Yeah.
Now there needs to be a rethink.
Well,
post-pandemic, there does need to be a rethink.
Of course there is. It's called social care, and successive governments have never addressed social care. Social care means how we're going to pay to keep people in health when they get old and they're infirm. It's an absolute time bomb problem. And it came home to me when I went to see my mum, God rest her soul, towards the end of her life. She was in hospital in Bournemouth, in a ward with 8 beds in it, and every bed had a very elderly person in it who wasn't even being treated. They just had nowhere else to go. And I thought, my God, how many wards have they got in this hospital like this? Just full of old people who are infirm, can't cope for themselves at home, don't have any relatives. It is a time bomb, honestly. And it's something which I totally agree with you. We've got to really address.
But your mum had relatives and you were a very good son. Yeah. Your sisters were very good daughters to her.
Yeah.
Was she in a residential care home before that?
No. My mum lived at home. She had her own little house, which we, you know, she looked after meticulously and we looked after for her, sent gardeners around, all that kind of stuff. You know, and she always wanted to be independent. But not every person who gets old is like that. I totally agree with you. We're all getting much older. Talking about age, by the way, old Francis Rossi is 72 this week.
He looks older, doesn't he?
He always looks
72, I think.
Yeah, he has. Did you have much to do with status quo during your illustrious career?
No, a bit before my time, but John Coughlin, who's their original drummer, and his lovely wife, Jilly, are very good friends of mine.
And
they come to the Scribblers' lunches that we have twice a year,
lovely.
Which is,
all
the old rockers and the old music writers and PRs and so on.
Yeah,
John is a stalwart member of the Scribblers. But I always think about when they opened Live Aid.
Yeah.
Status Quo opened the show with the obvious... It was the obvious song to open the show with, which was Rockin' All Over the World.
It's very aptly titled, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why they chose it. But the daft thing was they were still drunk from the night before. They ambled over the car park, guitars in hand. They didn't rehearse, and it kind of showed. It wasn't a great contribution.
Yeah.
But, of course, Queen stole the show. That day on 13th of July 1985, because they rehearsed for 3 weeks and they did a medley of their hits rather than going out there and bashing out a couple of tunes from their new album, trying to steal a bit of free promotion, you know.
But Status Quo were just coked up and pissed, were they? And they just turned up on stage.
We'd better not say coked up because we don't know that for sure. But
I can tell you, I've read the book about Francis Rossi and the other guy who died, sadly, you know, with the big blonde hair. What was his name?
It was Rick Parfitt.
Rick Parfitt, that's right. And they say in their book that the only way they could find out whether they'd had enough cocaine was to put their heads down and run at a brick wall. And if it didn't hurt... And they knew they'd reached, you know, optimum sort of cocaine induction level and shouldn't take any more.
They were great fun. I mean, every song they did, every single they put out, sounded the same. It was the same few chords.
Down, deeper, down.
That's it, yeah. They were just a bunch of headbangers, weren't they, really?
Yeah.
But an enduring rock band, they had 66 hit singles, 100 Top of the Pops appearances, and 434 weeks, i.e. 8 years, on the British charts. So that is not to be sniffed at, talking of cocaine.
It's not to be sniffed at, although they would have sniffed at anything in those days, as they said in the book. What I don't understand, because I know nothing about music, is people said, oh, Status Quo, cool. Just about the last thing you could ever call them was musicians. They didn't know any tune that had more than two chords. Apparently, two chords is the minimum you can use to make a song. And most people use, like, a lot of chords, 3, 4, 5 or something, apparently.
I think they might have known 3. But, I mean, look, they built a career on 3 chords, then we only have to admire them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've always said if somebody makes the maximum what they've got and makes it successful, even though it isn't a lot... then you should admire them. Vinnie Jones has always had a thing about me because Vinnie Jones was the footballer, as you well know, and he's been in the public eye quite a bit in the last 2 years. Sadly, his wife died. She had a heart transplant at my hospital, Harefield Hospital, and lived for many years after it, but sadly died of cancer, I think about 20 years later. Very sad. But he's been talking about, you know, the grief of that. But he's always had a grudge against me because years ago I said on the radio that, you know, for a man with such limited football talent, he made a fantastic go of his life and succeeded, played for some big teams, played for Wales, believe it or not, Leslie Ann, as a Welsh woman. He actually became a Welsh international footballer, even though when they were playing Italy, an Italian footballer on the other side literally said to the Welsh manager, what's that guy doing on the pitch? He can't possibly be a footballer, you know? And I related all these tales and Vinny got a bit fed up about it. But I, you know, when I communicated with him, I said, you don't understand. I was praising you. I said, you know, you're not the world's greatest footballer. And for a man of limited football talent, I thought you did extremely well. And he kind of sort of forgave me, you know. But there we are.
Just as well, really, because he looks very hard. And he doesn't actually look like a footballer anyway, does he?
No, he doesn't. I totally agree. He has a reputation, of course, of being the hard man. That was part of what he built his career on. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you for joining us today. I have to say, Leslie, I'm getting more and more responses to the podcast. And I know that you feel a little bit on edge sometimes because sometimes the responses are not particularly favourable.
Well, sometimes people are a bit rude, but I suppose we're a bit rude sometimes on the podcast, aren't we? So I think less rude, more blunt, more that we tell it as it is, as we see it. Life on Planet Porky, it can be a very challenging place sometimes.
Yeah.
So some people are gratuitously spiteful and they're just boring, really. They need to get a life and get something to do. They're probably bored.
Yeah, maybe. I look, the point is, they can only respond if they're listening. So it's good to know that so many people
exactly
from so many varying, parts of the listening base are listening. And that's great. I don't mind anybody commenting on what we do. In fact, in many ways, I welcome it, because if it starts to develop a pattern, then you think, maybe they've got something here. Most criticisms are one-off, but everybody's entitled to criticism. And as I say, I welcome it and I do not worry about it at all. Do you remember, Leslie Ann, we talked a couple of podcasts ago about, you know, and in fact, we've mentioned on this one, your long lunch with all your pals and the art of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Of making.
I'm not sure.
Yes, exactly.
You have to give me a clue. I'll
give you a clue. Oh, well, yeah. The art of making sure that what you're being told remains in your memory, and how we've talked about how we regularly had to excuse ourselves from the table and go off to the bathroom, and we'd whip out a notepad and a pen and write it all down and then put it back in our pocket and then go back to the table. A lot of people heard that and said, I can't believe you had such short memory. If people were talking to you over lunch, the lunch lasted an hour or two, couldn't you remember the things they told you? And I said, it's not that easy. Anyway, the reason I relate the story is because I read a piece the other day saying that the reason that Prince Charles always walks around with his left hand in the pocket of his jacket is because he has a notebook in that pocket and he has a pen in his inside pocket. And when the cameras are not on him, he will turn away and he'll pull his notebook out and take his pen out and write down notes on things that he's been discussing with the person he's been with or things he's been told. Now, I never knew that, but it just proves that you have to be able to do something other than retain information in your brain.
Definitely. I mean, he got it from me because I carry a notebook and pen everywhere I go. Yeah. And I write down everything too. I even, because my ex-husband was a pilot, not a professional pilot, but not a commercial pilot, but he had a plane and he flew his plane from Redhill to Cape Town to watch the cricket the year that we...
How big a plane was it?
It was a two-seater Cessna.
Wow.
Yeah, they put it in the sea off Rome in the end. I think it washed up a few years later. But anyway, They used to have this great thing, which I just thought was wonderful for driving, for the pilots. They had a sort of notebook, like a log type thing,
That
had an elastic around the back of it.
Yes, so I understand.
You could strap it to your thigh.
Oh, I see.
So that when you were sitting there flying the plane, you had a little pen attached.
Yeah.
And you could very easily write notes, because we can all write without looking at the page. It just takes practice.
Yeah.
So you could write notes while you were flying the plane with the other hand.
Yeah.
So I made myself one of these, a pad with an elastic strip around the back so that I could wear it when I was driving the car. So you pull up at traffic lights and some things come on the radio. You want to remember it or some name of a song or something like that. Mm. And there I could sit there and write my notes, you see. So I stole the idea. Mm. But I always write everything down. I've got thousands of notebooks. My kids are going to have such fun with those when I die.
They'll throw them all away.
Yeah, probably. Have a great big bonfire and get rid of mother.
Mm, maybe. But that's fascinating, that, because like you, I have to write things down all the time. And I normally just carry a little notebook around with me and write them down. But the problem is that throughout a large part of my life, I, you know, in working conditions, I've been inebriated. And I don't know if you've ever had this.
The great admissions are coming out now. Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever had this, but I've sometimes tried to decipher my notes the next day, and it is just utter bloody drivel. You know what I mean?
Do you write shorthand or longhand?
Shorthand. I still write shorthand.
Yeah, well, no wonder you can't read it. I did a course. I trained shorthand and typing, you know, because we needed those skills as journalists.
Yeah.
And because I'm left-handed and I write upside down,
right.
The whole point of shorthand is it's faster than writing longhand, right? But being a lefty, I was sort of drawing the shorthand across the page against the inclination of my hand.
Right.
And pretty soon discovered that I could write longhand much quicker.
Yeah.
So I just resorted to longhand.
Yeah.
The shorthand was pointless for me.
Yeah. I was taught T-line shorthand, not Pittman's. T-line was the one that all trainee journalists were taught. And I always liked to impress, you know, a young lady that I was out for lunch with or dinner with or something like that by scribbling something down in shorthand, you know what I mean, on the menu or something like that, because they would always say, oh, what's that? And I'd said, sorry, what? Oh, it's shorthand. Oh, really? Do you write shorthand? Yes. 100 words a minute. And then getting to
only 100 words a minute. I scored 120.
Yeah, well, you know. Women are more dexterous than that sort of thing.
Unless they're left-handed.
Unless they're left-handed, that's right, yeah. And that would always start a great conversation, you know what I mean? And it used to make me feel good. Ms. Jones, am I right in thinking that you have a sort of later life ambition to end up in a cottage on the Pembrokeshire coast listening to the sea rolling in as the waves crash on the beach?
It has crossed my mind. I think on reflection that I would not like to live there all the time and that I might like to have that little cottage just for weekend escapes.
Yeah, no, that's a very good way of doing it, because, again, we've talked about the previous podcast, talked about the, you know, the idea of living in the little village with the thatched roof, but it's too boring. But you're right about that. I, for years, had a second home on the south coast. At Gosport, and I used to love being able to look out over Portsmouth Harbour and the sea and all that, and used to walk along the Solent. The thing about the Solent is, because it's behind the Isle of Wight, it doesn't have any tidal flow, you see what I mean? So the waves weren't crashing in on the beach. And anyway, I've relocated my second home now to the Suffolk coast, okay? Because I do want to get that feeling of the sea rushing in and all that kind of stuff. And the reason I ask is because there's been a rush now to get to the coast because of lockdown, and people don't like the, you know, the, I suppose it's, you know, being closed in cities and all that that we've all had to do for so long because of lockdown. So I looked at the list here of the most popular places to go on the coast. Most popular is Salcombe in Devon, but the average price of a second home there is £950,000.
It's crazy. I mean, Salcombe's always been expensive, but prices have gone up 48% in the last year.
Yeah.
And the average price of a home is, I actually read, 980,000.
Yes.
That is absolutely mental.
Yeah.
Almost £1 million for a house in Devon.
Yes, I know.
And just an average house, not a mansion.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised that Salcombe's top of the list, because in the list I've got in front of me, the second most expensive is Sandbanks in Dorset, near Poole, which is
only... that I understand. Yeah, that's the sort of Malibu of the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, but I thought that was the most expensive. It is, of course, where Auntie Mimi lived, John Lennon's Aunt Mimi, and it's where loads of, you know, the establishment live now. Harry Redknapp lives down there, and, you know, pop stars and all sorts of... But, you see, I think this is actually second home value, you see what I mean? The average house price in Sandbanks is about 10 million quid. I know that for sure, because my sister lives just up the road.
It's mad, isn't it? A great friend of mine has just bought a house in Birchington on the North Thanet coast.
Oh, yes.
And I've still got cousins in Birchington, also Westgate, Broadstairs, Margate, all along that beautiful Thanet coast there.
Yes.
And so I've been down a few times recently. Prices have gone through the roof.
Yeah, they have.
And what they're saying is, oh, it's all down to the DVLs. So I say, what's the DVLs? Oh, the down from Londons.
Yes, that's right.
So people that no longer want to
live
in London.
Wouldn't that be DFL down from London, not DVL?
D- DFLs, I'm terribly sorry. Do you know who DVL is? That's Dame Vera Lynn. We always used to call her that. God rest her soul. DVL. Yes, you're quite right.
It's also driver and vehicle licensing.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. So sorry, Dame Vera. God rest your soul. Yes, the DFLs. And so prices have gone through the roof. It's going to be hell. Who will want to live there in a year's time?
Yeah, well,
but having said that, there is, according to all the financial pages I've been reading lately, we are due a massive crash this coming October when furlough will end. Lots of people will lose their jobs. Therefore, they won't be able to afford their mortgages. Yeah. The property market will be flooded and prices will come down. What I wonder about that is, what about the many empty commercial buildings, especially in London? Yeah. Because those were not built for residential purposes. It would cost too much money to convert them.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to all those office blocks?
Yeah, they might be converted into homes.
I don't think they will, as I've just said, because it would cost more to convert them than it would to knock them down and build new things.
I don't know. You read one paper one day and then on the next. I read something only a couple of days ago in one of the business sections saying that despite all this fear of people never using offices again and all that, there is a record number of applications to build new office blocks in central London. So you don't really know what to believe. Getting back to the coast, by the way, the most popular places after Salcombe and Sandbanks, Padstow in Cornwall, Lymington in Hampshire, that's near where I was. But the fifth one is Aldborough in Suffolk, which is near to where I have relocated to. 566,000, beautiful part of the world. I mean, you know, the Suffolk coast, it just absolutely lovely. But like you say, I think it's something that you do occasionally and not ever. I wouldn't like to live there. Now, I've got a problem here, Ms. Jones. I need your advice on, please. If I walk from where I live in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, to my local station, it's on a pathway. And on part of the pathway, there is a wall which is about, I would say, 3 feet high or 3.5 feet high, which has now been pushed completely out of sync by a tree that over the years has grown towards it. And I noticed last time I walked past this wall that the pointing is coming out, i.e. the cement between the bricks is coming out, and that wall's going to collapse soon. And you often see mothers with their children walking them past on their little scooters and all that. And I think that wall is imminent. It's going to imminently collapse because it's falling to pieces. I think I have a social obligation to ring up somebody, the authorities or the council or whatever, and say this wall's going to collapse. Because imagine if I suddenly discovered it had collapsed and fallen on a child, I would feel awful. Do you think I'm a busybody?
No, not at all. I'm onto the council all the time about all kinds of things. My latest campaign is about the overflowing rubbish dumpsters close to where we live, which are just people, the minute they're empty, people from other parts of wherever come and dump all their black sacks into and on top of these dumpsters. And then, of course, the foxes and maybe even rats, for all I know, come and drag it all out all over the place, and it makes a terrible mess. So I am straight on to the council about anything like that. Yeah. And I think you have a moral and social obligation to report that, because that could kill somebody, and that would be on your conscience.
I think I probably will. I think I'll we finish this recording. I think you're right. I think I have an obligation to.
They may not know about it, you see, because everyone thinks, well, somebody else will report that.
This is, it's a wall surrounding a block of apartments, okay? Now, every block of apartments has a site manager, and it also has a company who service the apartments. You know, they make sure that, you know, all the fire systems are done, all that kind of stuff. They should have spotted this and should have done it by now. But I agree with you. I think I have an obligation to do something about it. Quite right. As we get into the new weather, Ms. Jones, I'm not sure what your situation is at the moment, but do you have a bird feeding facility that you can put to use to help our feathered friends?
Yes, I have. I've got a lovely roof garden, and I have brought my bird feeder with me, and it's filled up with lovely fat balls, which I carefully carve in half and wedge into this bird feeder. But so far, no takers.
Right.
Maybe I'm just a bit too high up and they haven't spotted it yet.
Well, I'm not sure about that. What worries me is I've got a roof garden and I do all of that, bird feeders and all that. And I've tried over the years to get one that's foolproof to keeping pigeons out, but letting the smaller birds in, because the pigeons take all the food in my part of the world.
Yeah, they did in my garden where I lived before.
Yeah.
And also they would have these standoff fights with magpies and stuff.
Yes,
you know,
right.
Along would come a nice fluffy magpie to have a little bit of grain or something. And the pigeons get very aggressive and they flap their wings out to make themselves look bigger. And and they stalk the magpie. So off goes the magpie, starving, hungry.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, they're quite threatening things, pigeons.
Yes, that's right. So what I've done is I've ordered a new one called the Rome Wild Pest Off Bird Feeder. It's pest proof and pigeon proof, and it's designed so that only little birds can access it. So it's yet another new, you know, initiative to try and help the birds. And they don't need as much help in the summer, obviously, as they do in the winter. But I'm hopeful that once and for all, I've cracked it.
You're a lovely little David Attenborough, aren't you?
Well, you know, you've got to do your bit to help.
Got to do
your
bit, yeah. Must do your bit.
Remember we said that, we talked, I think, recently about how old are you going to be when you finish work and 65 and all that. Age discrimination complaints shot up by almost three quarters last year, according to shocking figures that lay bare COVID's toll on older workers. Now, this report also says, Leslie Anna, that at the moment, the reason why there's a huge shortage of bar staff and waiters and people serving drinks and food in hospitality locations is because, actually, Rishi Sunak made a mistake by extending furlough to September. So a lot of people aren't even bothering to go to work because they're getting paid for doing nothing.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Yeah, they need to do something about it, but let's leave that to the hospitality industry. You know.
Well, the only thing is, of course, it could impact on the price you pay for your drink and your food if they've got to start paying people more to work in those particular locations. Now then, Ms. Jones, as we speak, I can tell you that Mel B of Spice Girls fame is 46 years of age. She's had a pretty engaging life, hasn't she?
Yeah, I don't like her much, I must be honest.
Really?
I find her a bit brash and mouthy. You know, she put her kids through hell during her divorce and some terrible stuff came out during that hearing, long extended hearing, when she was her husband called Stephen Belafonte or something?
I think he was, yeah.
Just all kinds of disgraceful behaviour was made public. And she was quite shameless about it. And I remember looking at some of these news reports thinking, your poor children. Having to go to school and being taunted and teased because of the kind of stuff your mother shamelessly got up to when she was supposed to be bringing you up.
Yes, I agree. She's very mouthy in that very northern sort of way. Not that I'm against northern ways because I'm a northern boy myself. But she's clearly got huge personality. What I don't quite understand is that old Eddie, what's his name? You know, he's once the most famous actor in the world, Changing Places and 48 Hours. What was his name, Eddie?
Yeah, I'm immediately thinking Eddie Grant, but of course he was a musician.
He was but anyway.
Eddie. Anyway, him. Had a one-night stand with him or something, didn't she?
Well, no, I think it was more than that. I've seen pictures of them together, you know, in sort of social events and all that kind of stuff. But how did this girl from Leeds, with, as you say, big and brash and mouthy and loud, suddenly, I think did they get married? They certainly had a child together.
No, they didn't get married. But, I mean, that's what happens when you live in Los Angeles and you go to the same parties and you cavort with the same crowd.
Yeah.
It's not that unusual for someone from the UK to hook up with someone from the States.
Yeah, well...
Because that's where they all live.
Yes, and it seems a bit of a novelty, really, aren't you, or something like that. Anyway, there you go. Eddie, God, you must remember his name before the end of this podcast.
No, sorry, the more you try and remember it, the less it's going to come to you.
Yeah. Listen, I've just seen a review on a book. It's called Outbreak, and it's written by Frank Gardner, and it's a novel which he's written. Frank Gardner, I don't know if it rings any bells with you, but he's the security and diplomatic correspondent for the BBC. And I admire Frank enormously because many years back on an assignment, I think in Saudi Arabia, but it was certainly somewhere in the Middle East, he was shot four times, I think, by terrorists who were just being
Eddie Murphy, by the way.
Eddie Murphy, well done. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, Changing Places. That's right. Yeah. And Frank Gardner was shot and has been in a wheelchair ever since. And I have to say how much admiration I've got for him. He's continued to work as a BBC correspondent. He's on top of his job. He, you know, is an expert in his field and still travels around the world, you know, to locations, hotspots and all that, despite the fact that that wheelchair has to go with him. And I have to say that as you and I are in the same business, and I've done some of those things that Frank has done, I've been in places like Libya and, you know, been there when they've been bombed and the missiles have been flying in from American warships and all that kind of stuff. It's a terrifying business, literally terrifying. The fear, you know, just goes through you like lightning and all that. And yet Frank is still going back to those sort of places. And I think he's a credit to our profession.
Do you know, a couple of years ago, I was in the Chelsea Arts Club. Right. So before the lockdown year, I was waiting for somebody. We were going to have some dinner. Mm-hmm. And Frank Gardner arrived and he was in his wheelchair. And I sort of thought, I know this guy. I recognise this man. Where have I seen him before? Mm-hmm. And he sort of came over to my table outside. Mm-hmm. And he said, anyone sitting here? And I said, no, it's fine. And he pulled up to the table where I was and we got chatting. And he was terribly nice. Mm-hmm. I thought, what a really nice guy. And quite attractive, actually, you know, quite...
He's got a new girlfend, part of the story.
Well, no, wait, don't spoil the story. Right. So... in a way, he says, do you think anyone's sitting in that gazebo? Because there's a very nice gazebo in one corner of the Chelsea Arts Garden. And actually, at that point, there was no one. So I went across and sort of bagged it for him while he got his stuff together and then sort of went in there. And then shortly afterwards, up rocks a rather glamorous lady who's meeting him. Mm-hmm. And there they are under the heater in the garden, in the gazebo. And then my person arrived who I was waiting for and dinner commences. And a short while afterwards, I glance over to the gazebo and there's some nookie going on in there. Not actual nookie, but yeah.
Family show. Yeah,
they're getting it together in the gazebo. So I thought, okay, because he was wearing a wedding ring and I thought that it didn't look like the kind of thing a stable married couple would get up to in the gazebo. They were being quite friendly with each other, you see. Not long after that, it came out in the press that he had left his wife for some other bird. And I thought, I was in on this. Yeah. I saw the stirrings and the kindlings of this.
That's amazing. What a great
But I still think he's very attractive, yes. Yeah. I can understand why. People will see past a disability when somebody has all of that magnetism and intelligence and experience. Yeah. You know, look at how well David Blunkett did, the blind MP.
Absolutely.
He was having affairs left, right and centre, wasn't he?
Was, yeah.
So his disability didn't make him unattractive to women. That's what I'm trying to say.
Power thing, you see. I think power is a powerful aphrodisiac. But anyway, there we are. Oh, that's amazing. What great stories about Frank Gardner. I wish him luck with his new book, Outbreak. And, you know, everything he does in his future career, obviously.
Fantastic writer as well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, I haven't read it, but apparently it's got very good reviews. And said, you know, because it's laced with his intimate knowledge of how the security services work and all that kind of stuff, you know. So there we are. Right, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Been great to have been with you. Enjoy the heat wave. And I won't, of course, because I don't like the heat. So you'll find me under a brolly somewhere.
And sipping a cocktail.
Do you know what? I don't drink cocktails in heat. The only thing I can drink in heat is lager and lime, because if I start drinking wine or cocktails, I get dehydrated so quickly that it becomes unbearable. There we are.
I had a cocktail at White City House a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yes.
That was, what was it? It was vodka and champagne. Oh, my God, nearly blew my head off.
Would blow your head off. I don't mind those in winter, but not for me in summer. Ms. Jones, take care. And to everybody else out there, thank you very much indeed for listening. And we'll be back with you again very soon. Driven by this BJ Johnson guy, but Burt Bacharach, I think, had something to do with it as well. Anyway, look. I think you'd agree with me.
I always thought it was a Burt Bacharach song, actually. That shows how kind of sink in and out of history, doesn't it?
Well, hang on. Maybe BJ Johnson, over his name, was the guy who sang it. Hang on, I've got to find this. Wait a minute. I'm getting a bit upset with myself here. because I don't see what I'm doing, you know? Although
he's all over the place.
All over the place.
He hasn't got his notes together. It's all that beer you drink in the mornings.
No, let me see. Oh, here it is. I found it. Look, I'm on good form after all. I thought it was. Right, here we go.
He says this now.
Country pop American singer whose 1978 Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head rocked the world. BJ Thomas, the singer. Oh, you're absolutely right. He was the singer, but the guy who wrote it was, as you quite rightly say, you're ahead of the game again, Miss Jones, was Burt Bacharach. And he rushed over, you know, in the kitchen where all the drinks were, picked up my Strongbow cider, emptied it down the sink in front of me and everybody else, and said, next time you want to come in and drink my whiskey, bring something more than a bottle of fucking cider. And horrible.
Oh, language, Mr. Perry.
Yes, excuse the language.
Family show.
Yes, but that was direct quote. That was a direct quote.
Oh, I
see.
You know what
I mean?
Okay.
Sorry. So,
I'll let you off this.
I agree. She's very mouthy in that very northern sort of way. Not that I'm against northern ways, because I'm a northern boy myself.